Welcome to the Forency Podcast. Forency.us is a language training website for Hebrew, Arabic, and Russian designed specifically for intermediate to advanced learners. Our daily lessons prepare you to read real foreign language news articles and listen to actual foreign language media on a wide variety of subjects to put you on the path to language mastery. If you're studying Hebrew, Arabic, or Russian, you can visit our site at forency.us. That's foreignc.us. And enter the promo code Language Mastery for a 10% discount on our annual and 6-month subscriptions. In this podcast, I spoke with Me'ov Chofi, who is the director of the Arabic language program for international students at Givat Chaviva in Israel. We had a really interesting discussion about the intensive Arabic programs offered at Givat Chaviva, but we also got into the weeds on how Israel is a giant laboratory for the Arabic language, making it a unique place to study. I hope you enjoy the show. Hi, and welcome to the Forency Podcast. Today I'm here with Me'ov Chofi of Givat Chaviva in Israel. Thanks for joining the show.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
So I found you guys when I was searching the web, and one hobby of mine is I just search for Arabic programs overseas, and my dream is to not work and travel and just enroll myself in Arabic programs. So I found Givat Chaviva, and it looked really interesting because you guys are in a unique location in Israel where I think two worlds come together. So if you could just tell me about your background, but also just a high-level overview of Givat Chaviva and where you guys are located.
Okay, I'll start with Givat Chaviva. Okay, Givat Chaviva is located in Wadi Ara region. It is like in the middle of Israel, very close to the border between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. And our region is full, or many, many residents are Jewish, but also Arabs, like 100,000 Arabs are living here. So we are very much connected in the same area, very dense populated with Jews and Arabs. And Givat Chaviva is a center for Shomeret Tzair movement, educational center, and it works for peace, for equality between nations and between people. And now it is focused on many, many projects of shared society. It's a very vivid and living center, many, many projects, very interesting.
Right.
But we can talk about it later if you want.
And your official title is you're the director of the Arabic language program for international students at Givat Chaviva.
Exactly.
How long ago did you become affiliated with them?
I'm now working this project for 10 years. It's the 10th year from 2008. And we started this with the idea that we want to bring, and it would be very interesting for people from the world, Jews, Christians, also Muslims, to come and to learn the Arabic language and also to see the societies around, to connect between both, and also to have immersion activities to kind of really go into families and feel how it is, see it from firsthand.
Right. So before I dive into the actual program, I'd love if you can tell me a little bit about your background and your background in the Arabic language and teaching and...
Okay, so my background, I started at 17 years old in Givat Chaviva, actually. There was a special program for kibbutz members at that time, and I started there. I studied 8 very intense months, and then I was a field guide in the army, and I was very much into the south of Israel, where there's a lot of Bedouin living, so I learned the Bedouin language, and I lived with them after the army. And I studied, I have also first and second degree from Haifa University in literature, and Arabic language, and translation. And from that time on, I started to teach Arabic. I translate Arabic, also teach translation. And also I guide teachers because my focus is on how to teach Arabic. This is very important for me. Mm-hmm. So I guide teachers and institutes all over Israel how to do that and how to, for instance, now I guide the Yad B'Yad, hand-in-hand institute that have Arabs and Jewish kids, students. It's a very unique program, like 6-7 schools in all Israel, and I guide them to how to better the Arabic teaching there. So I also write books, which is my passion, to write books, programs. Even I wrote a television show, how to study Arabic for the Ahmadi group in Israel. It's a very special Muslim group here. So, what I do.
So I have to go back to you saying that you lived with the Bedouin after the army. I'd love if you can tell me just really quickly what that was like and how does somebody even do that?
Well, you know, at that age, you think that you can do everything. But I really wanted to know the Arabic language and I was very interested in different cultures that time. I was 18 and I decided to go to South Sinai and ask their people to help me to meet with a special place, a special tribe that I really liked that lives around a very unique historical place where the Jews actually, the biblical Hebrew people, roamed for 40 years. It's called Kadesh Barnea. It's a very little tribe living there. There's a big spring of water. And I wanted to know this special tribe and I got permission and somebody took me there and I had to walk like 10 kilometers through minefields. Now it's an area where Daesh is there. It's very dangerous to go there.
So maybe not the best place to go study Arabic at this
No, it's a beautiful area, but now Jabal Hilal there, a lot of Daesh is there, and it's very dangerous. Still that time, no Daesh. I used to go 10 kilometers and come back to a place where I could live and meet this special tribe. And after a while, they invited me to live with them. And since then, I used to go and live with them.
So just out of curiosity, how massively did your Arabic improve from being thrown into immersion like that?
Amazing. Amazing. My Arabic was very good. I could speak a few dialects then, the Palestinian dialects, the Bedouin dialect, and of course the rural dialect and the town dialect. Mm-hmm. And then later I studied the Egyptian dialect and, you know, so it's amazing.
And where are you from in Israel?
I'm from Wadi Ara region, from Kibbutz and Shemer. I'm living in a kibbutz of the Shemer Tzair, as I told you before, yeah.
So, and I don't want to get too off topic, but the subject of the different Arabic dialects is of extreme interest to me. So just for people who aren't familiar, if you can give a very high level overview of the different dialects that exist in Israel of the Arabic language. I know that the Palestinian dialect is pretty similar across the board from the West Bank to Gaza to the north, but there are subtle differences. So if you can just touch on those subtle differences, but then also talk about some of the major differences with the Bedouin dialect.
Yes, we have around 5 major dialects in Israel, around, okay? So we have the rural Palestinian dialect in this area, Wadi Ara, that's the center of Israel. And we have the Druze dialects in the north, Haifa area, like this area, and Golan Heights. And we have the Bedouin dialect in the south, that's the 3. And we have the Galilee dialect, which is more close to the Lebanese and Syrian dialect. Right, and we have the town dwellers dialect. So dialects are also geographic, but also according ways of life. Like, are you a nomad? And are you a town dweller, etc.?
Can you give a couple examples of differences? So in the region that you're in now, would local Palestinians say Halla for now, or would they say Issa?
They would not say Issa and not Halla. They will say Hassa.
Hassa, okay.
So the Bedouin will say Halhain. Hain is time in Arabic. So the Bedouin in the south will say Halhain, like this time, Halhain. And here will say Hassa. Town will say, in the north, will say Issa. And of course, the Galilee and also Jerusalem will say Halla or Halla, you know, depends.
And what about the different pronunciations of letters? So yeah, I guess the most obvious one is if the Bedouin use for the Qaf, the Qa, it's more of a G guttural sound. Yes. You can talk about that versus how it sounds in your area.
Yeah. In our area, the nice thing about the Palestinian dialect in this area, it resembles the Fusha. That's a nice thing, except one letter. But we can kind of oversee this letter. This letter is the Kaf, not the Paf, the Kaf, which here it says Cha. So they say Chif Halach instead of Kif Halach.
That's very similar to Iraqi dialect.
Yes, exactly. Maybe it was because the Iraqis were fighting here and I don't know the reason exactly why. But all this area of Wadi Ara, people speak with Cha, and there's difference between the men and the women. The men use less Cha and the women use even more Cha. So there's even dialects of gender if we add it to. So the Bedouin of the south will say Ga. Let's say they will say Gadi, is Qadi. So the Qa, they will say Ga. Mm-hmm. And the Dad, they will say Ra. So Gadi. But they have many, many other things, not only these two.
And are those dialects staying the way they are, or are they changing at all?
Of course they're changing. Everything is changing. Also dialects. Why? Especially because people are intermarrying. So the dialect, let's say, from the town will come here to Wadi Ara. So the children of the mother that came to marry here will hear her dialect and get so moving, traveling. Now it's more or less people are living in the same place and only there. So, of course, everything is changing.
And do you ever see Hebrew slang or specific Hebrew words being worked into Arabic dialects?
Of course. Of course, this is now a big problem in Israel for Arab speakers. Every second word is Hebrew, especially in certain fields. But you can hear half sentences. Some Arabs will not, or Druze, will not speak even Arabic. If I come with my group, so say, I can't speak Arabic anymore. I prefer to speak with you.
Oh, wow. Interesting. So obviously, I think that if it gets, whenever it gets to the point that the local community no longer speaks their native language, it's a sad thing for sure. I don't think it's a problem though when Hebrew words are starting to get integrated into the dialect, only because I see it as a natural progression of any language, you know, on earth. In the history of languages, all languages do that, and it's sort of an unstoppable natural thing that happens. Same thing happens with Hebrew, you know. Absolutely. Different words get worked in. English slang gets thrown into, you know, Hebrew slang.
Yeah, but here it's a bit more because it is relationship of minority and majority. Mm-hmm. That is a bit different. Maybe it's always, there's many minorities in the world, but minority always take more from the language, not just certain words that come in.
Right. How long did it take you to feel that you were fluent in the language? And what do you define as fluency?
I was fluent quite fast. After 7 months, I could understand. For me, fluency is to be able to understand a native speaker and to be able to speak and he will understand me. I don't have to understand everything. So it took me a few months to get quite fluent.
Right.
7 months, 8 months, and of course after being with the Bedouin.
And do you feel it's a lifelong process, even though you've mastered the language? Are there still, every once in a while, is there still something new that you'll learn that you didn't know before or something that you'll notice? Or do you got it down by this point?
No, every day I learn new words.
Right.
It's a process, a lifetime process. But you can master at least the basic things that you can understand someone, you can make him understand you. And that is the important thing, you know. Mm-hmm. We don't have to be perfect in the other language.
Right.
Of course, I learned every day new words. And the Arabic language also develop all the time.
Right. And are you speaking Arabic on a daily basis?
Yes, of course.
So now I want to get into the actual Arabic program. Before I dive into the different things you guys offer, I'd love if you can touch on your work teaching people how to teach the Arabic language. So what are the problems you see currently in Arabic language instruction, and what do you try to do to fix it?
Basically, the main problem of teaching Arabic, I'm sure you know it, is the Fusha al-Amiya. It's actually, right. It has like two languages, the spoken one, which has variety of languages, dialects, and right. The more formal language, which you speak in more formal occasions.
Right. And so for people who aren't familiar, Fusha is the formal spoken, the formal language that's of the news and newspapers. And Amiya was one of the words for spoken Arabic dialects.
Amiya is the spoken Arabic in daily life. It's the non-formal Arabic. It has many words in Arabic, many names like Lugha Darija, Amiya, Mahkiya. So I think everyone in the world, every institute, every school, they need to think about this problem. What do we teach, right? And I think in the West, generally, universities, also in Israel, you can say, generally universities more or less decided they'll teach only the Fusha. Even in very good universities, students learn to speak, which is amazing. It's an achievement. It's very hard. I'm sure you know it's why it's so hard to speak Fusha, because you have to speak with grammar. It is very grammatical ending of the Arab, the case ending. You have to speak with, you have to master it. But the problem is that it is like overseeing the reality of the Arabic life. Now, Arabic is vivid, is living, and it's also, you need to know the Fusha, you need to know the Amiya, each one of it you need for other parts of the life, other occasions in daily life and not in daily life. And I think I think it's a wrong direction that universities, it is very much based on historical approach to teaching Arabic as a language that is good for the mind. You develop your mind. It's so hard to develop your mind. And you need it because you just want to read newspapers. You just want to read essays. But today, you can't understand the Arab world only from reading essays.
Right.
And almost every news item that you see has Amiya in it and Fusha, because the minute you interview someone, he speaks in his own dialect. So how would you understand it? How do you say hello? The same thing in Israel. I went to speak to the director of the Middle East Studies in Tel Aviv University, and he told me, I have PhD students that can't say hello. They go to Jordan. They can't say hello.
Right.
They can't understand anything. And the thing that I see, I've just finished here with the world, that the books that are taught, they take daily life situations and they teach it in Fusha. Like to cook, like to travel, like to...
Right.
But this is something that I can't... I think it's wrong idea. You have to teach the Fusha as newspaper, literature, you know, articles.
Right.
But take the daily life in Armenia, which every Arab will do that.
And I just have to jump in because you're talking about something that's very near and dear to my heart. But just an example, if you YouTube, you know, how to cook, how to make kanafe on YouTube, you're searching for that, you won't find one video in Fusha or any Arabic cooking video at all. It's really hard to find somebody speaking in Fusha. You're always going to find them speaking in dialect.
Absolutely.
So that kind of demonstrating what you're saying is that it's no good to teach it that way. And I came out of the world you're talking about. So I started studying Fusha in the States, but they mixed the two together kind of, and it was pretty confusing for me. And as my own Arabic language study evolved, I found what worked best for me is to separate each one out. And I have Fusha living in its own world, and I have dialect living in its other world. And I have to keep them separate, because if I'm really into studying Fusha for a while, to turn that off in my brain is really difficult. And I just have to silo it off in order to focus on dialect.
Mm-hmm. This is for you. This is you. And also this is the way you study, because maybe you study 2 hours a week or 3 hours a week. But here we like to, especially for adults, to have more dense and more intensive courses. And there, when you study the two languages, they come one language. This is a nice thing that we do here. This is something that I want to promote.
Right.
When you study in the correct way, they become one language, and the Fusha helps the Amiya.
Right.
And the dialect helps the Fusha. This is what I do.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to say that they don't complement one another. I believe the Fusha is the base of your Arabic language study. You have to have it. It's not the funnest thing to learn. It's really not natural. It doesn't sound natural when you're speaking it. Like you said, it's not meant to be spoken. So when you're forced to speak it, it doesn't flow well. It doesn't feel right. As opposed to Amiya, that really does feel natural. As soon as you start speaking it, everything flows out, because that's the way people speak. And it's much more fun and
absolutely
beneficial, in my opinion. So sorry to cut you off. So if you can continue on what you advise Arabic programs.
I think that everybody should choose what he wants to focus on, of course. But I advise people in the world and programs to study both. Doesn't matter so much where they start from. For instance, in Givat Chaviva, we teach like 300 hours of spoken Arabic, Palestinian dialect, and only 100 hours, still it's a lot, of Fusha.
But you have to pick a dialect, correct? You can't, you can study Fusha in a dialect, but you can't study Fusha in three dialects.
No, you have to start from one dialect, and after a few months, you can start to introduce yourself to other dialects. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's just one day to move to another dialect. 2 days, yes?
Right.
If you study one dialect well, it will take you 2 days to move to another dialect.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I do with my students. Let's say we study the Palestinian dialect. In the end of the course, we go to Nazareth, to a field trip to Nazareth. And there, the guide is talking the dialect of the town. So I tell them, listen, this is a dialect, a few words, da-da-da-da-da. You have to know some sounds are changing. That's it. Let's start to listen. Let's start to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. One day they are able to do it. And the same thing I did with my students when we went to Egypt a long time ago. I made 2 days preparation. They swam like fish.
So you at Givat Haviva, you guys do a combination. You do a Fusa and dialect.
Absolutely. And I decided to, we decided to study more Amia because it's simply not available so much in the world, mm-hmm. right? So what I do is I teach the grammar, like Fusa, I teach a lot of grammar in Amia and fast. So let's say by the time we come to the verb, just give an example.
Right.
By the time we come to the verb in Fusa, that's in the formal language, they know many, many forms and they know how to conjugate the past, present, tense, and everything. So I just have to make, I wrote a textbook and I write it from Amia to Fusa. So I just say what you have to add. Let's say, instead of saying anakatabit in Amia, you say anakatabitu. You have to add two for me. Right. I wrote, you just have to add. So I teach them what to add and a few drills, that's it. They know it. I don't have to teach it from the beginning.
Right.
So that's the way I work. I could have done it vice versa. And also, let's say, when I teach to speak, very soon, like after a month and a half, 2 months, we come to a level where we start to speak about high subject, like identity, like feelings, like politics, like, you know. And of course, there you need many words from Fusha, many words from the formal language, because it doesn't exist in Amia. So we give it, just the ending would change. Let's say the feminine ending of Onsuria. Onsuria is
racism.
So in Fusha, it's Onsuria. In Amia, I would say Onsuriye. Mm-hmm. That's the whole difference. So when they say Onsuriye, racism, and they see it then in an article when we read about it, and of course they know it's racism. It has the ending of feminine. That's it.
So what are the main issues facing Arabic education in Israel versus the world?
First of all, I want to tell you that Israel is the biggest, it's like a lab, a very big lab for teaching Arabic because it's the only country that teaches in this scale Arabic as a second language or foreign language. So we have a lot of knowledge. We gain a lot of experience in this. First of all, the main problem is that Arabic is the language of the conflict. It's of the enemy, you can say, in Satan. Not everyone thinks mm-hmm. like this, but it's part of the conflict. And for kids, they want to study Arabic, you want to identify with the language you need. And it's hard to identify for many kids.
And what's the interest like now? Have you seen, I mean, 10 years, 20 years, are Israelis more interested in learning Arabic now, or is it fading?
Children, I don't know what is happening because I'm not teaching now kids or in schools. But I teach a lot of adults, and people do want to speak, do want to study. But the wanting or need to study Arabic in Israel is always like a wave. You can never predict it. Sometimes there's a year that many comes to study and sometimes less. Generally speaking, there is a need, especially of the people that come from the left, mm-hmm. people that believe in peace, people that believe in equality. For instance, I'm teaching now two groups Arabic. One group is the parents said that their kids go to the Arab Jewish schools. So they want to know to speak Arabic because their kids speak Arabic and they believe in it. Another group is teachers that work in hospitals and they need to teach Arab kids that are coming there and they're sick. So they want to know how to speak Arabic. So you see that two different groups, two different needs.
Right. So now I want to get into the different programs you guys offer at Givat Haviva.
Yes, we have our main program that is the longest one that runs for 10 years is 4 months. Now it was 5, but it turned to 4.
Okay.
I saw that if I teach in a different way, we can get to more or less the same level after 4 months and not 5 months. So it's a 4 month, it is operating twice a year, one from January to May and one from the second from end of August to December, 4 month each. Mm-hmm. And in this program, we study 300 hours spoken Arabic, 100 hours formal Arabic. Students sometimes come to a very high level because of the combination. As I told you before, mm-hmm. the year before, student went through a placement test, mm-hmm. in the university in the United States, and they passed the third year after 4 months.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You can, and I wasn't aware of it at all. They just told me, hey, Merav, you know, we went to this. And
right.
Also, a student, she wanted to go to Haifa University in the summer to study Fusha. They told her, sorry, you know, too good. We don't have anything to offer you in the summer. So it's not every year, but when good students come, I can take them to a very, very high level just because the combination, as I explained to you.
Right.
This was the idea that so two languages, they come together.
Right.
One knowledge.
I also think there's a difference in how the seriousness of how the language is how the language is taught in Israel versus the United States. And I've done both. I found in the United States, at least in undergraduate, it's taught more as an extracurricular. It's not taken, in my opinion, it's not taken very seriously. It's more, here's a taste. We're going to teach you very high level foreign policy and political words and literary words, but that's it. You know, you're not going to learn the how to interact with somebody on a face-to-face basis or even how people talk in everyday life. When I went to Israel, I found that they took it very seriously. It's very systematic, at least in the universities. So the Fusha is very systematic. They make sure that you master the grammar from having no background in it at all into being an expert in it. And then after that, they start introducing you into the dialect. But it's just a different way of teaching it. It's a different mentality. It's a really serious topic in Israel. And teachers who are teaching it have been doing it for decades.
I agree with you. We take it very seriously. Even the spoken language, let alone the formal language, in Batriva, we teach it very, very systematically. I wrote all the books. We have grammar books. We have text. We have videos. We have, and every week we have a test, and you have to pass the test. And we have tests in the end, and you have in the end to give a presentation in Arabic, like half an hour to 40 minutes presentation in Arabic about a topic that you research. You make a research and you give, of course, we help you.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very seriously thought of.
Right.
In the 4 months, we don't only study Arabic, we study also Hebrew sometimes. It depends if there's a need for that, demand. We study also Middle East history.
Just generally the history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, there's many, many field trips. It's part of the field trips, volunteering. You have a host family, Arab host family, and sometimes a Jewish host family, which you visit every week for afternoon. So all in all, you are hearing a lot of Arabic.
Tell me about the experience that students have visiting an Arab village and also having a host family. You know, how do their perceptions change from when they got there, from when they leave, and what sort of things do you see?
I think it's changing a lot. I think without even saying that, what I want is it's happening, that once you come and you actually get to know another culture, which is so different from your culture and your religion and your background, but there's a lot of thirst, I find, a lot of thirst from both sides to get to know, also from the Arab kids and girls and students. They really are so thirsty to meet the world. They want it. And also the world wants to meet, to understand. I think the most important thing is, first of all, to see how similar we are and how news are not saying the whole truth. And you can't understand this region, and definitely you cannot understand people, Muslims, Jewish people, just by sitting and in the library and writing, reading articles. And you have to be here. You have to get to know. And this is the main two things by where people come out.
And do you encourage people to stay with the host family when they study at Kibbutz Chaviva?
Yes, I tell them always that, okay, I make the first connections, but if you want more connections, let me know. And you just continue. Go with them and meet their uncles and meet their grandparents and meet and stay more and go to visit more.
Right. And from your opinion, what sort of impact has your program had on the surrounding communities and like the Arab villages that you guys are visiting? I'm sure it helps build bridges and
absolutely. I didn't make a research, so I cannot tell you.
Right.
But I feel that as much as we, like the West, we want to know about the East. The East wants to know about the West. He wants to change. He wants to, of course, to keep his values. Keep his values, but open to the new world, which is just an open world. It's very important for both sides.
So we have the four-month Arabic program, a summer program for beginners and intermediate?
We have actually beginners, intermediate, and advanced.
Advanced.
Okay. So I'll tell you what the difference is. It's 4 weeks or 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. You can choose.
Sorry? And if someone's thinking about coming to study there and they're not sure what level they're at, so they've been studying Arabic, but they're not sure if they're intermediate or advanced, how would you define the two?
It's very simple. I decided that the intermediate will be for students, like students that I know from Princeton that came last 2 years or other universities that speak Fusha. They know the language, but they cannot speak Amiya. So I have to start from the beginning, but I advanced it with them very fast. Do you understand? But this for me is intermediate. Mm-hmm. So beginners not know anything or just know the alphabet and, you know, study half a year, maybe a year. This is beginners. People that can speak fluently, and I assess them through a Skype meeting. Mm-hmm. I assess their level. We recommend the intermediate. And advanced people that already studied Amiya.
Okay. And then there's also a tailored program, which is really interesting to me. So if I'm coming to you and I'm saying, you know, I've been studying, I consider myself fluent in Arabic, but I'm not a native speaker. And I just want a program that maybe will take me up a notch or just really help me maintain and continue building my skills. What would you recommend to me if I'm coming to study with you?
Well, usually I tell the person, what is your budget? How many hours do you want? Do you want field trips? Do you want also immersion? Or you just want to study Arabic or Hebrew? But I think the minimum is 2 hours per day, mm-hmm. 2 hours, 3 hours. But also it's very, very expensive. Israel is an expensive place. And to come to a one-on-one program is very expensive. So I think 2 hours per day or 3 hours per day plus one trip a week so you can meet people, talk. And I also let everyone have a host family so they can go to visit on their own time, mm-hmm. either with buses or the family come and take them. So I think people also advance very nice then. So this is what I offer. 2 hours minimum for host family, at least one trip a week.
And when people are staying with the host families, do you instruct the host families to really try to speak Arabic with them? Don't revert to English and don't revert to Hebrew?
Well, we have this win-win situation, which I tell them that half the time they will get English. So our students help them to practice their English. This is very important in this region. People want to know English like perfect. Mm-hmm. So that's why people so much they agree. They want to take in students. They are not getting paid for it. They volunteer to it. And half the time they speak Arabic. So it's like very much a good solution because it works. People just want to take, they also give something.
So do they prepare meals for the student? I mean, when someone's staying with the host family, do they become part of the family?
They don't really become part of the family, but of course they invite them to eat, even though I tell them it's not necessary. But this is the Arabic hospitality. Food is very important as part of the hospitality. They will not leave you without eating and sometimes invite you to come to them with trips or to come to their weddings and events. So sometimes if you make a good relationship, you are more than just coming for one once a week.
And do people maintain those relationships after they leave?
Some do. Some do and some don't. We had very, very emotional stories. I can tell you one story is that we had a student from Portugal that came here. He was in Portugal. He was running a theater for immigrants. Very interesting. And here he made a project. This is something else you can do. You can make a project. He made a project with students in Baqa al-Gharbiya, which is a nearby village, and he taught girls to act. And they performed the end of the year. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. And he had an Arab host family, very religious. And he had a Jewish host family, which the mother of the family, her sister, she was involved in a bomb explosion. And she was afraid. She's for peace. She's for equality. Mm-hmm. She's living in Kibbutz and Shemel. But she was afraid. And he, in the end of the program, after 5 months, he made them come together and made a meal together. And so amazing things happen.
When people are coming to and they want to do a host family, I'm sure just not because they're Arab or they're Palestinian, but just because they're coming to a completely foreign world. How do you put people at ease to say, you don't have to be afraid? You know, this is what you should look out for. This is what you don't have to worry about.
Yeah, of course, we give everyone that is going to host traveling in Arab village, I give them the introduction, like what they should do, what they shouldn't do, what they should wear, what they should notice, and all this. And also we have like texts that we can learn very important things to say and not to say, like, you know.
Right.
You know.
So before we close up, I also want to learn more about what you're currently working on. I think you guys are working on an Arabic or an Arabic language education website that you're going to use in your program. Is that correct?
Yes, actually, I wrote with my friend, my colleague, her name is Ella Velstra, who wrote a program. I think it's a very good program for Arabic. It is now in Hebrew, but it's translated and it's going to be in the air. It's actually now already in the air, but only the first unit and how to write the Arabic script. So I'm not working on it currently because I moved to other projects, but she's continuing with this. It's a very good one. It's called Arabic to Use. It will be in the air soon, I hope, as a full program. It has videos. It has grammar. It has stories. Everything is recorded. It works like a personal laboratory, language laboratory. And it works on daily life and also more than that. And slowly, slowly, it raises the level until you can actually listen and understand things from the media, but in Amiya. So can I.
Okay, great. So is there anything else you want to share about Givat Chaviva before we close out?
Yes, Givat Chaviva is now placing itself as an organization that works on a local level and also on the world level with work projects. Like, it opened an IB school, international school, with students coming from all over the world. They come also from Egypt, from hopefully from Jordan, from the Palestinian Authority. And half of them, about 50%, should be from Israel, Arabs, and Jews. And it's a school focused on leadership and Middle Eastern leadership. And I think it's an amazing project. We have other many, many projects of, it used to be coexistence. Now we don't like so much words. We speak more about shared society, because shared society, we live together, we do things together. Not so much live together, but do things together. Help each other. Coexistence is to live side next to each other and not so much to interact too much.
So Ta'ayush versus Mustama Mustarak.
Yes. Aywa. Mustama Mustarak. Zabt. Very good.
Well, it sounds like you guys have a really special program there. I would love to try to make it out there sometime and
please
and visit, and maybe you can tailor a program for me.
Come to visit.
So if people want to visit your website, they need to go to www.intensivearabicsemester.org.
Exactly.
And then just go to the contact us page, correct? And
yes.
And send you guys a note.
Yes. And they can go also to the mail. Our mail is intensivearabic@gmail.com.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate you spending time with me, and I look forward to talking soon.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Bye. Masalama.
No, bye-bye. Alay salamat.